Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Will English remain the dominant common language for people who speak different mother tongues? Although it's hard now to imagine the importance of English declining as a lingua franca, my guest today is quite certain that at some point in the future, native speakers of other languages will not see the acquisition of English as a requirement for success in global business dealings. They are also, he says, unlikely to brush up on their Hindi, Spanish, or Chinese either, unless those are the languages their friends and family speak at home. Nicholas Oestler is chairman of the Foundation for Endangered Languages. His new book is called The Last Lingua Franca, English Until the Return of Babel. Nick, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Define lingua franca for us.
Well, a lingua franca I define as a language that you want to learn, that you choose to learn, and so you find some way of learning it. It's a language which you learn essentially in a process of recruitment. I contrast it with a mother tongue, which is the language each of us grows up with, what we learn in our home environment, and often actually we do learn from our mother.
Mm-hmm. And is there any doubt whatsoever that English is the lingua franca of the current era?
Well, it's the most widespread language in the world. Mm-hmm. And if you add up not only the people who speak it natively and perhaps in their work, but people who have some competence on it because they've learned it at school, there are as many such people as there are any other language spoken in the world. The only competition, of course, is Chinese, mm-hmm. Mandarin Chinese.
And that, in many cases, is mother tongue for the people who
yes,
speak.
Yes, of course, it's dominantly mother tongue. Although, of course, some proportion of the Chinese population have learnt Mandarin as a lingua franca, mm-hmm. the language that so that they can be good Chinese citizens and take part in China to the full.
Why is English the dominant lingua franca of this era?
Well, the background is in history doesn't. Mm-hmm. need much repeating. The British Empire established English-speaking presence on every continent in the world. In your continent, it did so by settlers spreading out. And so, in fact, it was the spread of some sort of mother tongue competence in English. Mm-hmm. But in places like India, it was spread by people learning English because they wanted to get on with the British. And that sort of phenomenon of what I've elsewhere called language learnt by re-education mm-hmm. Is what has accounted for the worldwide use of English. People have found that it's the most convenient language to learn because so many people around the world already know it.
Since the decline of the British Empire, it would seem the economic dominance of the United States has played a major role in the need for
yes,
English
I'd
language
agree with
skills.
That.
Yeah, can you talk about, is there something to the fact that Americans notoriously, and I know I'm generalizing here, but Americans notoriously tend to speak one language only?
Well, you could say that currently the worst offenders are the speakers of English in that monolingualism.
Mm-hmm.
What's the word for someone who speaks only one language? Well, you might say an American, or you might actually just as easily say an English person.
Mm-hmm.
It is the tendency all over the world and throughout history that when there has been a global or a large-scale dominant language, the people who natively speak that language make less effort than others to know other people's languages. I mean, the Russians in the period of the Soviet Union were notorious for not bothering to learn anybody else's language, although there were, dozens of languages spoken officially in the Soviet Union. But similarly, people in the Roman Empire, if they happened to be Italians, were also notorious for not making any effort with anybody else's language. Cicero once said that it's not so much a credit to speak Latin as a disgrace not to.
Hmm. And
so it's a phenomenon which goes back a long way, but we do see it well instantiated in native speakers of English, certainly.
And it makes a certain amount of sense. It may be regrettable, but human beings, even those who want to learn additional languages, have an almost universal affection, primary affection for their mother tongues.
I think that's right. And, of course, if your mother tongue is English, you tend to somehow feel that other people who learn it more pragmatically must have a similar affection for it. But I think this is a delusion.
Is English is notoriously a difficult language for non-native speakers to learn. Is it particularly good or bad as a lingua franca when you compare it with the others that have been used down through the millennia?
Well, English is simpler in some ways in that it lacks most inflections, that you don't have special endings to put on nouns and verbs, other than to indicate plurality and to a little extent tense. So from that point of view, English is a simple language to make yourself understood in. You don't have to learn lots of complexities before the basic intent of your utterance becomes clear. And certainly you probably don't have to listen hard for such complexities in order to understand fluent speakers' utterances. But it's never been necessary for a language to be simple in that way in order to become a lingua franca. A Latin, I mentioned just a moment ago, is notorious for its large-scale complicated verb systems and noun systems and the agreement that has to happen between nouns and verbs and nouns and adjectives and all sorts of things. So it takes you a long time to learn it. But it was learned essentially perfectly through the school system for 1.5 millennia. That something like 80 generations of people went on learning the language perfectly just in order to be able to use it later in life. So this simplicity business is perhaps an ease, but it's very difficult actually to know what simplicity is also. If you think about Chinese, I was being picked up recently by David Fronce in claiming that Chinese was a simple language. Well, it is simple in the sense that if you have a sentence, it's all consonant, vowel, consonant, vowel, consonant, vowel. 我不说中国话. There's very little what a linguist would represent as complexity there. But people find it difficult to learn, nonetheless, if they start from a language, from a European language. So what constitutes simplicity is rather difficult to pin down.
So whatever language you were born speaking is the one that's simplest to speak.
Well, inevitably to start with it is, yes.
How in the world was Latin able to survive the fall of the Roman Empire?
Well, that's very interesting because this is a sort of a well-kept secret. People tend to associate Latin with the Roman Empire and its success with the Roman Empire. But it's in fact, it's spread as a world language was just as much due to that successor institution of the Roman Empire, the Roman Catholic Church. Missionaries were spreading all over Northern and Eastern Europe from the period of the barbarian conquests on through to the end of the first millennium AD. And where they went, they often succeeded in converting royalty. They may have even fought their way into power in these. This happened a lot in Scandinavia. Christianity was spread on the blade of a sword. But once they were in power, the rest of the population very soon picked up on the royal religion, and Europe became a Christian continent. And when it did that, then it required all the accoutrements of a proper Catholic country. Namely, you had administration organized often by monks or other clerical officers in Latin. And in this way, the second half of Europe was Latinized after the fall of the Roman Empire.
Does a language evolve in a different way when it exists only as a lingua franca in the way that Latin did? You know, we speak now of it as a dead language. Therefore, I can't imagine it's changing very much in the way it's taught.
Well, Latin was distinctive in that it was spread through the school system for a long time after it had actually ceased to be the language that anybody learnt as their mother tongue. Mm-hmm. English has not had that property. You know, other languages such as Russian, French, even perhaps Greek, never really had that property. They remained in touch with a vernacular language, a mother tongue language, throughout the 1,000 years in which, in most cases, these things last for. So it isn't really necessary to go into this rather strange pickled existence which Latin had. And, of course, English at the moment is... world English is mutually comprehensible with native speaker English. There's no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a problem as things stand at the moment. It might become a problem, perhaps, if the native speaker versions of English spoken in your country and mine and perhaps in Jamaica and Singapore and places go off in different directions and world English is left on its own as globish. But as I occupy in my book, I don't think it's very likely that this is going to happen.
What influences whether or not a lingua franca develops as a sort of pigeon of a combination of different languages, or everyone sort of agrees that there is one, maybe pure is the wrong word, but one language that will be used that actually exists by itself?
Oh, you mean when do you get a situation where a pigeon arises?
Right.
And when people accept a language?
Mm-hmm.
Well, pigeons arise sort of at the rough edge where two language cultures are in contact with each other, often for trade, but also often for more nefarious things like slave trade, sometimes even police work. But you get a situation where nobody has actually taken the trouble to sort of organize communication, but somehow the meaning has to get across. And so a pigeon arises. Now, a pigeon is a language which is intrinsically, it must be a lingua franca. It must be a language which is learnt specifically in order to do some special activity, typically trade. And if it is passed on to a later generation, it will become a mother tongue, and those mother tongues are called creoles.
Mm-hmm.
But if the activity which has caused the pigeon to come about doesn't last for very long, then the pigeon will go away again quite soon. I mean, that's what happened along the shores of the Indian Ocean after Portuguese spread round the coast there. It was never very good Portuguese. It was not Portuguese which would have been recognized in Lisbon, but it was good for the first century or so when traders were establishing themselves round the shores of the Indian Ocean. But there was a very turbulent history involved there. The Portuguese were only the first of the traders to come round the Indian Ocean, smartly followed by the French and the British. And so the Portuguese language, such as it was, didn't get a proper foothold in those areas. It was used as a pigeon by traders who would be coming in, you know, new generations, and to some extent it spread as a creole among lower class Christians round the, because they were sort of seen as low class by the people who stayed with their traditional religions in that area, and then after a time it just died away because none of the Portuguese traders were there anymore. There was nobody trying to speak Portuguese. And then English went on to spread, but it spread in a more formal way. And even in China, where pidgin English had been established for the early days for informal trade, people began to say, well, no, we're not going to do this anymore. We're going to learn proper English. And that's what's happened.
Nicholas Osler is my guest. He's chairman of the Foundation for Endangered Languages. His new book is called The Last Lingua Franca, English Until the Return of Babel. Join our conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/PlanoCFP.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Nicholas Osler, chairman of the Foundation for Endangered Languages. His newest book is called The Last Lingua Franca, English Until the Return of Babel. Join our conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372. I guess we should have talked about this earlier, Nick, but where do we get the term lingua franca?
Yes. Well, lingua franca was the language which was spoken in the Eastern Mediterranean really at the end of the first millennium. And it was mostly used by people whose native language was Arabic or Greek, trying to make contact with the Venetian and Genoese traders who dominated the trade in that part of the world. And so it was actually meant the Frankish language, because they thought of these Europeans as sort of Ferengi, Frange, Franks.
Okay, so you talk about three things that are likely to bring down lingua francas. The three R's, you call them ruin, relegation, and resignation. Can you talk about each in turn and how it might relate to what's about to happen, or I shouldn't say about to happen, but what ultimately might happen to English?
Yes, when I started sort of expanding this concept, I was assuming that languages would sort of, if they spread by the sword, they would die by the sword. And if they spread through honey, they would die by honey or whatever. Hmm. But it doesn't seem to work quite like that. Basically, ruin means that the economic reason for the language has gone away. In some sense, the civilization which has spread its language, often in a mercantile way, sees the end of its economic dominance, and so that ruins the language. Examples of that, I mean, are very typical, the ones that we talked about, the pigeons. When the trading activity which had supported a pigeon goes away, the language is ruined, and it's gone. The other sorts of language, the kind when a language is relegated, is more a government activity. So that is what I was thinking more in terms of a language which has been spread imperially, such as Latin was, at the point of a sword, mm-hmm. creates an empire, and then somebody else takes over that empire and says, we don't want your language anymore. A very good example of that is Persian, as it was spoken in India and in Central Asia in the 19th century. This is a language which had lasted for 1,000 years, had been spread largely by Turkic imperialists in previous centuries down into India and across Central Asia into what is now Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, that area. And in both cases, the new imperial power, which were powers which would have been inconceivable in a way when the language originally spread, came in, took over, and after a time said, we're not going to use this for official purposes anymore. This actually happened in 1837 in India, when the government decreed that the courts would no longer use Persian, but would use a mixture of English and the vernacular languages. So in some sense, it was represented as a more democratic measure. In the case of the situation north of Hindu Kush, where the Russians were in power, very little happened until the Russian Revolution. And you've got a whole lot of intellectuals saying we're going to provide properly literate vernacular languages to be spoken all round what was the Russian Empire had become the Soviet Union. One of the things they did was to say, well, Persian can have its part of the Central Asian area, and we shall call that language, however, Tajik, because it's not really the same as all the other Persian. And everywhere else, people will speak their own vernacular language, which was mostly some form of Turkic, things like Kyrgyz, Turkmen were given their own literacy, and tacitly in the background, you said, but of course, if you really want to get on, if you really want to be in touch with the rest of your socialist brethren, you should be learning Russian. Mm-hmm. And so effectively by government fiat, the rule of Persian in that area, the role of Persian as a lingua franca, was set aside, and it hasn't come back again.
It is interesting.
Those are examples of ruin and relegation. Resignation is a more subtle thing when the elite who had relied on a certain language, for one reason or another, ceased to be dominant. Lingua francas are not democratic institutions. They tend to be associated with a ruling elite. Mm-hmm. And ruling elites do not last forever. A very good example of that sort of failure was the way that Latin came to the end of its tether in the 15th and 16th centuries in Europe. You might have thought that what with the invention of the printing press and the discovery of the rest of the world outside Europe, which was going to be falling under European domination, Europe's lingua franca, Latin, would be going from strength to strength, but not a bit of it, because there was so much turbulence socially, and essentially the rise of the mercantile bourgeoisie in this era, that vernacular languages stepped in and were seen to be adequate for all the purposes for which previously people had wanted to use Latin. Mm-hmm. People just actually had to learn other people's languages in order to do it. The dominant language, if there was one, turned out to be French, but it had nothing like the universal appeal that Latin had before. And this all happened because socially the elite, which had been in power, ceased to be in control. Effectively, they stepped back, they resigned, and that's why I call it resignation.
There have also been parts of the world where political borders have been drawn according to the overwhelming majority of the people speaking this language or that. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, a situation where at the end of the British Empire, in the 1950s, 1960s, areas all over the world which had English as their de facto lingua franca were forced to make new decisions. And it's quite interesting, if one looks around, say, the Indian Ocean again, that different decisions were made. In Malaysia, for example, where the elite had spoken English, there was a sense that in order to give the new country, the new independent country, its own status, its own self-respect, that Malay should be brought forward as, which was the majority, the language of the majority, should be brought forward. Now, this created new social problems because although the Malays were in the majority, their status and certainly their general level of wealth was lower than that of an influential minority, the Chinese. So what were we going to do about them? If they had stuck with English, then they could have perhaps said, well, that's a neutral language. But of course, that would in practice not have given a level playing field, because in that situation, the Chinese, who were better at English than the Malays, would have dominated. So what they decided to do was to make some political concessions to the Chinese, but to stick with Malay. Then, of course, they have the problem of what are we going to do about foreign policy and being in touch with other countries where English seems to be an advantage. And you see other countries, such as Brunei, not far away, thought that since we're a small country, we can't stand on our own, we must pay more attention to the language we need for foreign relations. And they hence emphasized English more. And you see, the decisions could go either way, depending on the balance between the need to assert national identity through language and the need to balance different groups within a country. The Indians seem to have got it fairly right in that by changing their policy in 1960, they said they were going to get rid of English. They decided in 1960 that, in fact, they couldn't afford to get rid of it. In to the south of India, in Sri Lanka, They started by thinking that English would give too much advantage to the Tamil minority. Therefore, they switched the national language to Sri Lanka, to Sinhala. But then they found that this caused the most immense social problems, effectively a state of civil war, which has persisted for most of the last two decades. They've attempted to resolve it, found it was quite difficult to resolve through linguistic policy, a war which had been started by linguistic policy. And in East Africa, you can see neighboring countries, which were in a very similar situation before the withdrawal of the British, like Kenya and Tanzania, have taken different approaches. So Tanzania does not have official English, whereas Kenya does. It's all got to do with the balance of powers within those countries, which minorities can be used, and how wise the rulers have been in balancing the different interests. It's a very complicated story. I hope I've given it some sense.
Yeah, Nick,
how it works.
I want to talk about this because many people have looked at economic trends and population trends, and they have said, well, if English is no longer the lingua franca, then Spanish or Chinese or Hindi or something else will rise to supplant it. Why do you disagree with that?
Well, because partly it's a result of eyeballing the map. If you look at where those other dominant languages are spoken in the world, they tend to be localized. So Spanish outside Spain is all in Central and South America. Chinese is essentially a phenomenon of East and Southeast Asia. It's very difficult to see such a language having a means to project itself into all the continents of the world to becoming truly global. So there's that situation that no language is as widely distributed as English is now, and it's quite difficult to see how any other language could somehow repeat the kind of history which English has had and achieve that. At the same time, there are technical developments in information technology now, which mean that more and more it's going to be possible for people technically to provide interpreting and translation. It's not there yet, but one can see the sort of means which are being used can easily be projected onto languages all over the world, and the more that computers get faster and cheaper, the better it's going to get. So this is one case where I have simply tried to extrapolate a trend that I see. I see it's actually going to have quite a catastrophic effect on the world and its need for lingua francas. And that's why I call English the last lingua franca. I don't think there's going to be a call for any lingua franca after after English.
You have looked at something called a virtual language called Pali that gives a much more less technological and maybe more organic sense of how this might play out. Can you talk to that about that a little bit?
Yes, the case of Pali is a very interesting one, and I gave it as an example of how languages which are originally adopted as lingua francas for means of pragmatic communication become associated with a religious faith. And so come to have a holy status. And once that holy status is established, in a way it sort of takes over, and it doesn't matter whether language is still any use as a lingua franca of communication. So what Pali is supposed to have started out as is an attempt to represent the middling average sort of Indic speech which the Buddha used with the early Sangha, the early Buddhist church, and in which the Buddhist scriptures were first of all memorized, and later on, much later on, perhaps 500 years after the time of the Buddha, began to be written down. And so this language has accompanied a major sect within the Buddhist tradition throughout the 2,500 years that it's been in existence. Now, you mention it as a kind of virtual language because most of the people who learn Pali, in fact, all the people who now learn Pali, learn it as part of their Buddhist devotions. And they learn it from the viewpoint of their own languages. So people all over Southeast Asia, speaking very, very different languages, are learning Pali, and they pray in it. And to some extent, they may even listen to discourses in it, which express their religious ideals. Now, it's difficult to imagine two languages more different, say, than Thai, spoken in the center of Southeast Asia, and, say, Sinhalese, which is an Aryan language spoken in Sri Lanka. It's so that when people speaking Sri Lanka speak their Pali, it comes out in a relatively straightforward form, close to what Indian languages are. Mm-hmm. But when Thais who have learned this language in the course of their history and have gone on using it from generation to generation, mispronouncing it, you could say, in the same way that is caused by the very strong accent which the Thai language gives them, they end up with a language which is pronounced differently from Sinhalese Pali, is written in different letters from it, and in fact it's used in quite different ways, because by and large the general facility and knowledge of Pali which prevails in Thailand is much less and more stylized, one could say, than what goes on in Sri Lanka. So they think they're using the same language, and they are using the same language because they have the same scriptures written in it, which they revere, and quite a considerable amount of their sort of religious activity is identical. But from the point of view of a linguist coming from outside and seeing the languages that they were using, he would probably say they were different languages, simply because they are so different in their details.
Nicholas
Oesler, the soul, in some sense,
is my guest.
Remains the same.
Got to take a quick break. Nicholas Oesler is my guest. His new book is The Last Lingua Franca, English Until the Return of Babel.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/PlanoCFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is chairman of the Foundation for Endangered Languages, Nicholas Oesler. His new book is called The Last Lingua Franca, English Until the Return of Babel. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. So, Nick, let's project ourselves into the future a little bit, whether it be years or decades, assuming that we have developed a technology that can accommodate for syntax and accent and regional colloquialisms, and I can speak into my phone or whatever it is and be completely understood somewhere where no one understands my mother tongue. In a way that's comforting to think that you could travel and be understood and understand other people, I can't help but think that we will lose something if we don't undertake the study of other people's languages, because language has so much to do with culture.
Yes, undoubtedly we will lose something, just as quite a lot was lost. For example, when Latin died out in the 16th century, people were pointing out, there was no lack of people to point out, saying that if you really want to understand and make yourself understood around the world, you've got to learn this marvelous, expressive lingua franca. And certainly, to some extent, if you wanted to have the advantages which they saw were possible, you needed to do that. But people like Descartes decided, well, I can't be bothered to do that. I'm thinking in French. All the people I want to discuss this with can understand French too. And the other people, well, they can try and catch up if they want to. So I'm afraid that the trouble is that the decisions are not made simply in terms of the higher fitness of things. It's all about individual reckonings of what they can get away with and what they care about. And, from the higher fitness of things point of view, some things will be lost. And I think that probably will be the case. I mean, speaking as someone who enjoys the struggle and a challenge of learning foreign languages and to understand what people get out of them, I think it's a pity that I think this is going to be less necessary in the future. But this is the way I see the future of the technology.
Do you think that school children will be forced, just as a thought exercise, to continue to speak some, to study some foreign language?
Well, my experience, even in my short life, watching what's happened to the decline of teaching of foreign languages in my own country, suggests that democratic politicians very readily yield to the call that, why do we need to do this stuff? Everybody speaks English anyway, don't they? Can't we get away without it? Now, what is actually beginning to be said more and more in my country, I don't know how it is in the US at the moment, is that when people are being appointed to international jobs, they are looking for people who speak English and something else. And that, of course, enfranchises most of the world, or sort of the elite competitors at least, except for the British. So these things can boomerang against you. And but let's not be too romantic about all this. When interlingual communication has taken place over the centuries, it hasn't tended to be at the subtlest levels. People have had their finest linguistic experiences predominantly, I would suggest, in their mother tongues, if those mother tongues have a developed literature. And indeed all languages have some form of cultural background, which to some extent is a closed book to people who learn it late in life.
What do you make of the argument that media will preserve lingua francas, at least in the countries that are producing a great deal of this and exporting it to places where it may not be their mother tongue, but people learn the language to enjoy the media? Of course, often there are translations.
Yes. Well, it will have some form of preserving effect, but there's new stuff coming along all the time, of course, and people don't spend an awful lot of time with the oldies and goodies. There will be, when things are valued and they are seen to be in a medium which is becoming less accessible, then no doubt they will be interpreted and translated as necessary, just as most people read their Latin literature in vernacular translation now, rather than struggling with the original languages.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Bobby Lee in Arlington. Hi, Bobby Lee.
Hi. Well, to some extent, the gist of my question was answered right after I called in when you started talking about the rise of these vernacular languages. But regardless, this is still a fascinating show, not necessarily for so much for its exposition of how English got to be where it is and where it's going, but just language, the rise of languages in general. Along those lines, I think it's fair to say that maybe languages, dominant languages, or specifically Latin, never really dies out completely, in that when I was taught my fragmented knowledge of Spanish, it was termed a Romance language, along with French and Italian, as being descended from Latin, that they have a stronger connection to Latin than other languages like English. Along those lines, I was wondering if you'd heard, if you agree with this, if you'd heard that where the language that is spoken today that is most closely resembles Latin is a region of Italy, an island, Sardinia. If you agreed with that, and if that can tell us anything about the difference between the bulk of Italians and little isolated areas where closer varieties of Latin are still spoken.
Well, that's a very interesting question, Bobby. It's sort of beside what we've been talking about. In my earlier book, I talked about the two deaths of Latin, in the sense that in the first case, Latin became, as a vernacular language, split up into lots of different languages, including this one that you're referring to in Sardinia, which has been recognized as being rather different and more similar to classical Latin than even Italian is, and certainly than the other Romance languages spoken in other parts of Western Europe and Romania. So I don't in any way dispute your facts, but what we're talking about here is mother tongues, that's to say vernacular languages, and what happens to be the case is that there's language change everywhere, which is what accounts for the fact that where once one Latin was spoken, there are all these different Romance languages. But language change may in some cases not be particularly strong. And so that certain changes, particularly the change of k to ch and g to j, so that the word for for Caesar, for example, which was Caesar in Latin, has in most parts of the world become Caesar or Caesar. It remains as Caesar in Sardinia, and similar things with gamba and jamba for leg and so on. These things take place in different speed in different parts of the world, and where it doesn't happen, where it happens not to have happened very much, you get a conservative language which looks like the original. But the social features which distinguish dialects don't necessarily work in coordination with this. The first person to write about the Italian dialects and the different way that the what they call the Roman language was spoken in different parts of Italy was Dante. And Dante notes that Sardinian Italian is more like Latin than what he spoke, for example, or many of his the people he respected spoke. And he doesn't give them any credit for this at all. He simply says that they are idiots who appear to be imitating the original things, but they are not to be seen as the originals. So he's not actually prepared to accept the authenticity of he's not prepared to see authenticity in this greater conservatism of some of the dialects.
Some of the most interesting words that we use commonly in English actually are nifty terms borrowed from a variety of other languages over time. Will we lose that in English and in other languages, that back and forth sort of trading of terminology?
No, I think borrowing is something which is characteristic of English. I mean, you can see it if you compare English with Chinese, where there's virtually no borrowing. They invent new words to express new concepts translated out of basically Chinese word stocks. But English doesn't do that. English has a tendency to, when it comes across a new concept in a new part of the world, simply to take the word along with it. I'm immediately thinking of the word budgero for what some point, and this is a particular sort of barge which was widely used in British India. The British did not call it a barge or any of the previous words that they had for that sort of boat. They called it a budgero, and wherever they used it, they did that. And indeed, certain other forms of housing that they found in use in fact in Bengal, they called the Bengal house the bungalow. And that is now England is full of bungalow cottages. So there's no reason to think that the sort of charm and exoticism which comes about through the borrowing of foreign words will die away at all when English is no longer spoken so widely. it will still no doubt be in contact with other places and other languages, and will go on adopting things from them, perhaps less than it has done in the past, because it will get less stimulus. But there's no real reason to expect that to change at all.
We have an email here from Paul who indicates he is nearly monolingual and living in Terrell. Now that communication by internet, including text messaging, is universal, will ease of keyboarding influence which languages are most widely used?
Well, I might think it would have done, yes. For a long time, in the late 19th century and most of the 20th century, people thought that languages like Chinese and Japanese were at a great disadvantage because they had so many characters that it inevitably slowed down the speed of all typists in trying to generate text. The thing was that there was then some intelligent research work done actually in the Toshiba company in Japan, where they discovered that actually if you typed in the sound using the small keyboard that we have, the typical QWERTY keyboard, you could use the computer intelligence to detect which of the many variant characters should be used, and it could display them to the user quickly in order for him to choose between them. So that effectively ingenuity overcame this keyboarding problem. There's another problem which comes up with large numbers of different languages in that there are different alphabets which are used, and for a long time there was no computer standard which would tell you how to write your Gujarati script and when you're writing Gujarati. This problem has largely been overcome, and there is a single system now known as Unicode, which is adequate for typing the world's languages. It's likely, I think, that this will tend to prevail, but since it comes from a particular part of the world, namely California, there may be nationalistic concerns which will limit its spread in other parts of the world, which may be becoming more dominant quite quickly.
So, Nick, we just have about 15 seconds left, but I have to ask you, you speak 26 languages. Is there something special about your brain, or are you just very curious and very diligent?
Well, I'd be happy to say I'm curious and diligent. I'd also happy to say that anybody can get in touch with as many languages as they want to in our age. That is what I'm really talking about. This is what my publishers are talking about when they give this improbable number of languages to me. I certainly have been prepared to dabble in all these languages and have got useful things out of them.
Let me say, I have to stop you there. I'm so sorry.
I would urge all people to take that opportunity.
We're out of time. The new book by Nicholas Osler is The Last Lingua Franca. Nick, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Well, thank you too, Chris. It's been a marvelous hour.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.